Welcome to Crosstalk. Thank you so much for joining. Please like and most importantly, subscribe. Your subscription really helps us. And, you know, we are a 401(c). What that means is we are a nonprofit, and our goal eventually is to raise money for people to get help, get scholarships, or get some sort of therapy, something that works for them. Thank you so much again for joining. And today I have a good friend, and I've known you for, 6 years now. Joey is here to join us and tell us his story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Irene.
I'm so excited.
I am as well.
There's so much parallel in our lives, like New York. And I mean, I can't wait for you to tell the nitty gritty. So what we do here on Crosstalk is you will tell us your story. You can get as nitty gritty as you want, or you can just, you know, whatever you feel comfortable sharing. You know, we just how you grew up, what happened, you know, and what does life look like now, but also what did early recovery look like? So just, you know, when you do take us through your recovery process, like what did the beginning look like? You know, how has it evolved and what does it look like today? It's really important for the message. All right.
I think I can do that.
Okay. So tell us, where did you grow up? How did it all start?
So I grew up outside of Philadelphia in a small town called Ambler. Ambler was primarily Italian. So I grew up with two sisters and my mother and my grandmother. So I was basically raised by all women. My father lived just 3 miles away on the other side of town. So I was always back and forth with my dad. And yeah, life, a lot of love in Italian. I was the only boy, so I was getting a lot of love, getting a lot of attention, you know, getting spoiled with love. So love was never like, you know, my problem. It was, or attention. It was, maybe it was too much attention, honestly. From an early age, I had a lot of friends, and, you know, I had a great upbringing. I really did. I had everything I needed. But what happened was, like, I started to get really involved, and my sister was older than me, so she had older friends, and I wanted to hang out with the older crowd. And, you know, with that came drinking and all the stuff. Back then it was smoking and, you know, like hanging out. And I could honestly say I remember, like, the first time I had an obsessive thought about alcoholism, about alcohol.
Really?
I was like probably 14 or 15. I think the first drink I ever took was at a friend's bar mitzvah. But a few years later, we had too much beer on the weekend. We had to hide it in the woods until next weekend. And every time the school bus would drive by, I would be like, I want to go get that beer. Like Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday morning.
So you had the obsession.
I had the obsession early.
Young age.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just the party. It wasn't to like numb any pain, because I wasn't really in pain.
The effects.
Right. I liked the effect. Alcohol. And I liked to like party.
Yeah.
And the partying was fun. So I had a lot of fun partying, even up through my 20s, until it wasn't a party anymore.
Yeah, right? I can relate
and,
to that.
So I grew up, was raised outside of Philadelphia. You know, both my parents are deceased from alcoholism. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that, you know, it's funny, whenever I speak, I kind of like, I go over that for some reason. I don't know why. I mean, I've processed it through therapy.
Yeah.
But it was tough. Like, I remember as a teenager, my mom not being able to get out of bed.
Really?
And it was because she had hepatitis and she was on a medication that she was having interactions with.
So
she ended up passing a few years after that. It was 1996. I was around 21 years old from malpractice of that medication.
Wow, okay.
So
That was for treating the hepatitis.
Correct. So my father and my mother both had hepatitis.
Okay.
Right? My father's was untreated. I guess they just didn't feel it needed medication.
Interesting.
I don't really recall why, but I remember my mom went on that medication and it ended her life. She was 41.
Wow, right? I mean I'm older than her.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
I've outlived both my parents at this point.
I feel like my life just started.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. It was tough. It was tough because, like I just said, like, I was partying through my 20s, and this was like early. I was still wanting to have fun.
Yeah.
This was like an inconvenience to me. When you're a selfish alcoholic like I am, it was an inconvenience. Like, come on, mom. Like, what's up? Now I can't do this. And that, honestly, that's right. how I was thinking.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to go back to New York and do all this stuff. And you know, right around the time, my mother was in a coma for 3 months, right before she passed. And I was at the Super Bowl in Arizona when I got the call. I was out there with some friends. My buddy swam for ASU. We went out there to watch the Super Bowl. And I got the call. I came home. I was partying for like 3 straight days.
Yeah.
And I had to go to the hospital and see my mother like that.
Wow.
So the 3 months leading up to her death, I had a friend of mine, a bar that I would frequent in Manayunk, which is right outside Philadelphia. And one of the owners only hired women as bartenders. And he's like, take a shift, whatever shift you want. You need to get your head off of this. So I did. So I started bartending there. And drawing a big crowd through a bunch of friends and stuff like
and
that.
And you're so good looking.
And that's where I got scouted. That's where I got scouted to get into the modeling industry. And I was like, this lady would come in and I was like, not interested. You have no idea. I had long hair.
Right.
And you know, after the third time she came in, actually I ran into her at another bar and she came up to me. She was like, seriously, I want you to take this serious. And you know, long story short, I was in New York in 2 weeks and I was in Paris doing the shows in 3 weeks.
That's incredible. What a story.
And yeah, it was like, and my mother had just passed. So I was like, this was perfect.
It was like the perfect
distraction. Take me away from the crying Italian family and let me just get out of here.
Yeah.
Needless to say, I wasn't too successful in Paris then because of the partying. I just like wouldn't show up for things. I wouldn't be where I needed to be. I was late for everything. So I went back. They sent me back to New York after like almost a month. Went back to New York and it just got worse. The partying, just, I couldn't control both of them.
So it was like, were you still modeling and partying or did you go back to bartending in New York? Like, how was that? How were you managing like a career, you know, a whole new career?
So early on when you go over to do the shows and if you have a successful season of doing the shows and some of the designers like you, hopefully you can get a campaign.
Yeah.
Maybe you can spin off some lookbooks or like maybe do some catalog stuff for them. That wasn't the case for me. So I was pounding the streets for castings. And then I started bartending again. The agency was like, that's not a good fit. You can't be out late at night. Obviously, you can't handle it. So they got me a job at Armani, working the door at Giorgio Armani on 64th and Madison. And
I know that store well.
Am I going to be a doorman? And they were like, no, you're going to be a greeter. And they put me, like, decked me out in all these clothes, like full three-piece suits, top hat, gloves. And I just stood out front and said hello to people.
I remember those guys.
And my roommate did the same thing at Prado on 72nd and Mad. So it was
amazing.
Like, those were the jobs to get through. And then once I found a few markets where I worked a lot, mainly I worked a lot for Germans, believe it or not, when you have, like, an ethnic Italian look. Germans like you.
Right.
When you're Italian, a lot of the Italians like the Germans and
that's so funny, and
the Swedes and stuff like that. So my work was Miami, is where all the Germans used to shoot in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd work in Miami and then Miami for like the season, like 3 or 4 months. And then I would go to Germany for like 4 or 5 months. And then I would go back to New York.
So at this point, you're talking about the 90s. You're talking about the fashion industry, high, fast fashion, or maybe not fast. I don't know if that fits. But anyway, was alcohol still the only problem? Or did you partake in dry goods too,
A good question. When I was 21, like so right after my mom passed, or actually that weekend when I was away at the Super Bowl is my first real introduction to partying with cocaine.
Yeah.
And that took me, it allowed me to stay out longer, it allowed me to drink more, it allowed me to be more social and go to more parties. So yeah, that was fun until that wasn't fun anymore, you know?
And it gets ugly.
It does.
And gross.
And you know, it was a double-edged sword. The industry that brought me in also accepted this, right?
Right.
So if you're like having a rough night, you can have a drink before work. Like they like encourage it. Like,
right.
You look like shit. Anything you need to do is straighten yourself out. Like, let's go. Hurry up.
Yeah.
So not all sets.
Remember though, I worked for the Gucci Group. I worked for Bottega and for YSL and they accepted it. Especially, I mean, I was there for some of the castings, for some of the things. It's very much there. It's presence.
And back then it was.
Yeah.
In the 90s, it was really different.
Yeah. The worst is when I worked for the Montezemolo family, like they owned Ferrari and Fiat. Mm-hmm. And well, their relative, one of the relatives there is just a mess. And I remember he would show up just a mess.
Yeah.
And that was like when I really started to see, oh my God, this is like really a part of it.
When I really knew I had a problem, like I always hung out with the guys in New York that liked the party as hard as I did and would go till 6, 7, 8 in the morning. And you maybe the next day, go right through the next day. But when I got to Europe and I had a few roommates that were either Dutch or, you know, I would see how they would act after a few drinks or mm-hmm. they would act after, you know, doing some dry goods. I was just, it's like, wow, this is, I'm so different, right? I definitely have a problem.
Yeah.
I definitely have a problem. So fast forwarding a little bit, that went through like my 20s. So like I said, my mother passed away with a malpractice. So that case was settling. It was a big lawsuit against the hospital and the doctors. And that case settled when I was in my mid-20s. So now I had money coming in, right? It was a seven-figure settlement, money coming in. And I would just go right back to Europe. I'd go right to Miami. I'd go right to New York. And I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't book any jobs because I would never show up for any castings. But I was telling everyone that that's the industry I was in and I was living off of that money. So then I was like, wow, this is a double life right now. You're right. So
yeah, you're lying. Years,
I was lying to everybody, switching agencies left and right to so no one caught on to me. And that didn't last long. That was like a year, maybe.
And you're probably burning through the money, right?
Burning through the money, burning through friendships, relationships, business relationships, just burning through everything.
I can relate so much to all of that.
So it brings me to around 28.
Okay.
Right? That was the first
time. And what year is this, if you
don't mind? This was when I was 28. So it was like 2000.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
And I guess I'll go into the story. It's a little crazy, but like I had a lot of groups. I had a lot of friends from high school that were all getting married around that time, right? So I was the groomsman in two guys' wedding, and they were in the same month. And I ended up like giving a girl an STD that was like a public figure of one of my friends. She was like a bridesmaid. And I was a groomsman.
Right.
And that turned into like one of the biggest lawsuit fiascos.
Oh my God. You got sued for that?
$6 million.
No way.
Yeah. Agency in New York dropped me. The girl was like, I just want you to tell me that you gave it to me. I ended up lying and say I had to fly to Miami for a job. Right. And she knew
you had to pay her out $6 million.
I can't talk about the settlement and stuff.
Okay. Okay.
It was all, so it all was settled.
Yeah.
But
crazy. Okay, yeah. Sorry.
But no, it's okay. But what happened was that was the first time I really was like, this is resentment.
Yeah.
This is like, you know what?
Yeah.
F you. You're going to come after my money. It just happens that her brother-in-law was my finance guy, knew that I came into all this money. So, you know,
that's so, it was, so messed up. Kind of, too. Yeah. Anyway,
You know, my friends that I was friends with for life were like testifying against me and it was a civil case.
Yeah.
So, you know how I handled it? I picked up, flew to Switzerland, opened up like 5 bank accounts, transferred all my money over.
Right.
And I was like, tell her I went to Vegas and I lost everything. Like that was just like
what you wanted to do.
And that was every time I brought that up to my lawyer or anything, I'm like, that's the worst idea ever.
Right.
So I tried to execute it. Didn't go well.
Right. Well, Swiss, it's not what people think, right?
It's like, not. But back then it was a little.
It was better. It
I've
was
already
easier,
had accounts
but, yeah.
open because of work. So it was successful getting it there, but it wasn't successful living through that.
Right.
I started feeling so much shame and guilt and like I'm hiding, I'm running.
Yeah.
So that led to my first stint in rehab.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So how old were you for this stint?
27, 28.
And you decided to go, or was this friends getting at this point? Are any of those friends your friends, or are you so angry at all of them that you kind of?
So angry at all of them.
Yeah.
Went to Switzerland with my sister, flew back to New York, said, all right, I'm getting out of here. I'm getting out of New York.
Yeah.
For some reason, I landed in Denver.
Okay.
So I said, I just rented a car, drove to Denver. This is where I'm going to start my life over. I'm going to get out of this industry. I'm going to get into like endurance sports and skiing and be a healthy, just want to move on. I had the means, right?
Yeah.
Let me just start a new life. I didn't know if it was 6 o'clock at night or 6 o'clock in the morning. I was drinking around the clock.
Right.
I had like zero ambition responsibility. It was a pure disaster. I went to Vail, and it was like, people were like, it's going to be fresh powder tomorrow, like snowing, and I couldn't wake up till like 11, right? And it was just like, my life was so unmanageable. I kept calling an 800 number from this hotel in Vail. And this lady, I still remember her name today, Tony Tartufo. She spent like 2 days on the phone with me, and she got me to a treatment center in like Newport Beach,
well,
California.
Tony Tartufo, if you are listening.
If you are listening.
You saved this man's life.
Well, she introduced me to the first treatment center.
Yeah, the seed.
Which
she planted.
I stayed sober for over a year.
And I think that no matter what, even if you did relapse or, you know, it wasn't the end all be all place, it still plants that initial seed like, oh, I have a problem and I may have to do something more serious than just like moderation,
right,
or, you know, learn how to drink like a gentleman type of thing.
Right.
Which is so funny.
And I remember when I went there, it was called Pacific Hills. It was in San Clemente, California. So it's like around Newport down south. And I remember saying, they were asking me, what was the longest time you've gone without drinking?
Oh my God. I'll never forget when they asked me that question. What did
and
you
I
say?
I was like, well, I only really drank on weekends when I was young, but every weekend, maybe there was one weekend I had to go away with my family. He's like, you want to call it 14 days? So I was like, yeah, I guess I haven't been sober for more than 14 days. And I thought about it. I was like, yeah, I've done something to alter my mind for, you know, so that was it. And it was like, when I first accomplished 14 days, I remember like 21 days and 30 days in there, I was loving it.
Isn't that crazy? I remember that question. I got to detox and she said, when was the last time you were clean? And I was 34 years old and I had to think for so long. I was like, you mean nothing? Like not a prescription, not an alcohol. And it was from when I was 16. And I was like, I've been drinking and taking something and altering my state of mind for 18 years. And that is literally in that moment, I was like, I probably belong in this detox center. You know what I mean? I couldn't believe it. Because on the plane ride, I was like, maybe if I, you know, kind of like trying to justify like I just had a bad week or something. Right.
Well, it makes me think, going back, when you asked, was there anything other involved more than alcohol? And it was, you know, on the weekends, party, ecstasy, coke, all that stuff. But every day I lived on these things. Back in the 90s, they had them in smoke shops in New York City, and they were called mini thins. They were ephedra. And if you take like five of them, you're buzzing around town.
Oh, so I was taking Adderall, you were taking ephedra.
Yeah. And then I later got introduced to Adderall. But before I knew about Adderall, it was these mini thins and ephedra, and it was just like anxiety ridden. So when I got to treatment and I got off of that stuff, I was like, all right, now I'm calm. I'm not sweating. I used to think I had a problem with like perspiring. I was like, no, it's not.
Right. All this anxiety, I wonder where it's from.
So I finished at Pacific Hills. I was there for like 45 days.
Okay.
And they said, go to any length to stay sober. That's the one thing that really clicked with me. Mind you, I'm living in Denver. But I'm not really living in Denver. I had like, you know, just got an apartment, but I could get out of it.
Right.
So I decided to move to Santa Monica.
Okay.
So I had a sponsor. Well, this is actually a really good story. So I flew that day back to Denver. And my plan was, let me get like everything together so I can move out to California. And then maybe I can like start modeling again now that I'm sober and healthy and like start making some money. And I go to the first meeting in Denver. I love this story. And I tell this story because I still talk to him all the time. I went to a young people's meeting, Denver University, Monday night, first day out of treatment, put my hand up. They told me, put your hand up and ask for a sponsor. So I said, my name's Joey, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm from Philadelphia, and I'm looking for a sponsor, preferably an endurance athlete, because I moved out here like 3 months ago, and I never really got on the bike or started skiing, but like, you know, if anyone's interested, please let me know. This guy comes up to me after the meeting, right?
Preferably an endurance athlete.
This is what he says. He comes up to me and he goes, hey, 16 marathons, 23 triathlons. I'm from Philly. My name's Tyler. I'm your sponsor. I said, you're shitting me. He goes, I'm dead serious, bro.
Wow.
What's up?
That's awesome.
We're going to dinner. Let's go.
Yeah.
And I went with him and he was the most interesting guy ever. And we're still friends to this day.
That's awesome.
I remember when his kids were born, his wife, and they got married.
And he's sober, obviously.
So Tyler is 54 with 34 years.
Amazing. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Like,
incredible.
Stud.
Yeah.
Like, big book guy, total old school guy, never went to treatment.
Right. Good for him.
And he comes down here, right? So he comes down here, and he said this November, hopefully he can come down here and not only give me my coin,
right,
but give his son.
Oh,
his son's
that's
in the program.
So cool.
And his son called me like 6 months ago and just said, hey, my dad gave me three numbers to call. I'm struggling right now. He's like a junior in college.
Oh, my God, I have
and
chills.
I was like, yeah, and I go, Ewan, I remember you in diapers.
Wow.
Like, I remember you in diapers. This is so cool. So I'm like holding tears back. Like,
I'm holding tears. Like, that's
I'm
incredible.
Like, giving Ewan like advice. And I was like, your father helped me so much. So I hung up the phone with Ewan. I called Tyler.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, you'll never believe it. Just called me.
Yeah.
I was like, your son. He was like, I love it. He goes, I gave him three numbers and I was hoping he called you.
Oh, good. I'm so, so cool.
So
I love
cool,
it.
Right?
I love how it's like a merry-go-round,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's like a college athlete. He's, you know, good looking kid. So he's probably struggling.
Yeah.
You know, wants to stay. He's bad. He knows he has the disease.
Yeah.
I just pray he's okay. All right. And I'll see him.
Yeah.
Either way.
Yeah.
I'll see him.
Yeah.
So I was in Colorado. Tyler took me through the steps.
Yeah.
Right? I was about 6 months sober. We're cruising through the steps. I was going to work with him. He was a woodworker.
Okay.
So he did like custom cabinets in these big, beautiful homes and like parquet floors. So I would go to work with him. I don't have any skill in that.
Yeah.
But I was like cutting wood, being the labor, and we would go to work with him and his dog, and we would talk about recovery, right? And that was like that's what I needed. I needed like male camaraderie is healthy to show me a better way of life.
Yeah.
And he did. But I was getting the itch. I was looking good. I was looking better. I was healthier. My eyes were white. I was like, you know, not holding that puffy face from drinking so much. So the business started calling. We're like, hey, do you want to come back? We booked you to, and when they say you want to come back, they say, here's a 10-day job in Spain.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
like, let's lure you back into the business. So
right.
I was like, okay, I'm not turning that money down. All right, well, I'll just do this one. And Tyler's like, we can do this, you know, like we could talk while you travel. So I did.
Right.
So I started getting back into the business. I started
working.
There's
definitely people who are sober,
yeah.
who are models
oh,
and
yeah.
actors, tons of actors.
Guys,
you know?
That I worked with back then, I see on Instagram now, they're celebrating 20, 30 years. And I was like, they never told me this, like
right.
back then.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So
that's crazy.
I did. So I started working again and I told Ty, I was like, listen, I don't want to go back to New York. I just don't. There's too much baggage with the lawsuit and I thinking about going to LA, right?
Yeah.
So he's like, I support that. So I got the year, I moved to LA, and I was trying to get dialed into like a home group and stuff, but my excuse was I was traveling so much.
Yeah.
And you know what it was? It was just like I was just so consumed about me and working again that I put all of my recovery aside, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, I went to a job in Miami. I was living in LA. It was a big job. It was a campaign and it was shot outside and it rained. It was like, it's like the weather now. So mm-hmm. we couldn't set up the set. And then, so they just called the job after 2 days and then said, we're going to do it in 2 weeks. And the clients were from the UK. So I went back to LA. While I was there, I was struggling because I wasn't drinking and I was going out with the clients to mm-hmm. dinners and I wasn't drinking. I didn't call Tyler. I was in a bad place, but I didn't drink. I went back to LA and I thought about like, I was like, I'm getting close to drinking. I need to get back and like start doing the steps.
Right.
So I went back to that job in Miami and we went out on the wrap party. There was like a table of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell one guy on the other end of the table was rubbing his nose.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kept circulating bottles of wine and champagne. And at the end of the dinner, they knew I wasn't drinking. I would push the stemware away. And at the end of that dinner, someone knew someone at the table and someone sent a bottle of champagne, like a Magnum, over to the table. And they're pouring it. And the person that was pouring it just poured it right in front of me. And I just grabbed it and was like,
yeah.
And someone sitting next to me was like, you don't, wait a minute, you don't drink. And I was like, honey, grab the guy, rub your nose. Come here. I need to see you over
yeah.
in the bathroom.
So it was like
was on.
Engines running.
And I didn't even know it was coming. It was like, damn. And that was it.
It happened so fast.
Yeah. And that was like I said, it was the wrap party. So I had like an early flight out back to LA the next day.
Tons of money in your pocket?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. Like.
There you go.
Exactly. And it was, didn't end well. Didn't end horrible. But I went back to LA. And that guy that just happened to be sitting across the table was like a, you know, he was an art director. So he was promising me more jobs. And he had this crazy house in Beverly Hills and like would throw these parties. And it was like, I would go do one party and then had to recover for 3 or 4 days. And then I was back in the cycle again.
Yeah.
Before you know, I was back in the cycle.
So bye-bye, Tyler.
Yeah. Still talk to Ty, though. Still talking to him.
Oh, you still were?
Yeah.
Did he know? Did you?
Yeah,
were
of course.
Lying
I,
him,
no,
or did you
no.
Him?
I told him.
Okay.
I told him. I was like, bro, I just, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'll tell you what happened. He's like, you're not praying, and all you care about is you.
Right.
He's like, you're in an industry that all you care about is you. So I didn't get back. I didn't go back to treatment. I never was involved in like halfway houses and stuff like that. I don't know why. I should have. I needed it, but I didn't.
Right.
And then I continued to just keep
drinking. Well, if you don't know, no one tells you, no, then you don't know what you don't know.
Remember when I said I was looking for an endurance athlete? So I did start racing, right? That's one part I missed. So I did start racing. The reason I went to Santa Monica is to be on this one team. So I trained in Colorado in altitude. I went to Hawaii and trained in wind in Hawaii. And I studied in Hawaii for like 6 months. So I had this like really cool story.
Yeah.
Like in that year, I built all this up. And then I went from nothing again, like zero.
Right.
And I had a lot of friends within the tri community, LA tri team. And then, you know, I started to start feeling sick. And this is a crazy part of my story. And like, I started feeling like I'm colorblind. And I was losing a lot of blood in my stool.
And you didn't know?
And I didn't know. Oh, and my sister was in LA visiting me. And she was like, what is that? And it was like all blood. And then I would go out and try to do a race. And I was like almost falling off the bike.
Oh my God.
And my one friend said to me, he's like, you need to go get your iron levels checked. And I did. And they were off the charts. And I ended up having Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And I just ignored it, Irene. If I told you the story, we probably don't have enough time, but if I told you the story of how many, like, not, they're like coincidences. There's God moments of like people he put in my life. One guy I was racing with was like, my girlfriend just got diagnosed. And this is who she saw. And like,
yeah.
I ignored it. Saw him in LA, or I saw him in New York like 6 months later. And I was like dying. I was literally dying.
God.
So I couldn't drink. I couldn't party. I was just ignoring.
Were you in
symptoms.
Like a hospital bed?
So no, I didn't go to the hospital.
Okay.
I went back to New York, was working. And then I was like, I went on a job. It was in Chicago. Right. And they heard I got sober. They heard I looked great. They're ready to work with me again. So I went out. They called my agent. They're like, something's wrong. He looks green. They're like, are you sure he's sober? I'm like, I don't know if this is going to work.
Yeah.
So I did like one or two shots. Then my friends doing those shots, like retakes of my outfit, I was like, wow. And they pulled me aside. We're like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And I was like, listen, I was just in the hospital for a day. I have Crohn's and colitis, nothing to do with drugs or alcohol. Like, I swear.
Yeah.
And they were like, all right, well, listen, sweetie, you got to go back home and address this. So I went home and ignored it.
Yeah. Listen, sweetie.
Yeah. And I flew out to LA. I don't remember if it was for work or to visit my sister. And yeah. I went to Cedars-Sinai in Beverly Hills. I went in the ER and I was there for 3.5 months.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. So what does that look like? Like blood transfusions?
So
actually, it's funny. My partner has colitis and he was in the hospital too. So now it's under control. Like, there's like Remicade, like he does some sort of like IV treatments
Remicade,
every couple months.
It's infusion, biologic. Yeah.
He does infusions like every 2 months and he's fine.
Yeah. I do
it
one
under control.
I do one every 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So,
or maybe he does every 6 weeks.
Was in the hospital. They tried to calm it down with medication.
Yeah.
IV, heavy duty antibiotics wasn't taking. They decided to remove my colon in
second
month.
Yeah.
Right. Then I had a complication with that surgery. Now I'm down to 125 pounds.
Wow.
Like I wasn't eating.
And
they
you're
had
like
me on,
a tall man.
Yeah. I'm 6'1", like 180 at that point.
Oh my God.
I went down. I lost like 60 pounds.
Yeah. That looks
I mean,
scary.
But it was bowel rest for 3 weeks, feeding me with like IV, like feeding tubes and stuff. Yeah. And it was just like an eye opening. Wow. Life,
hard.
Lifestyle change.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
So I got through it though. I had family fly out. My sister was there with me. I get discharged. There was this 3-stage surgery. The guy says, I could do the second and third. They're 10 weeks apart. But if you live on the East Coast, you're most likely going to want to go to either UPenn, if you're in Philly, mm-hmm. go to like Sinai or Presby in New York. Or if you were my son, I would get on a plane and fly down to Cleveland Clinic in Weston, Florida, and have him do it. He's right. The best.
He's just there recently.
He taught me. He's the pioneer of what you have going on. So I did. I took him up on that. And I've had 14 surgeries from him.
Wow.
I had 17 surgeries total.
Holy wow.
Yeah. So, but this is why I had so many. Because of the industry I was in, I didn't want the bag. The bag was an ileostomy or a colostomy bag was the answer for me. But I just wouldn't accept that.
Yeah.
I was like, listen, doc, you have
anything
this procedure.
Anything you could do.
Right.
Anything you could do.
And he goes, well, I can do this, but I can't guarantee you're going to get a lifetime.
So if you were to redo all that today, would you have a bag or would you not? Or you don't know?
Well, yeah, I would have to say I'd have to take the bag.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what happened now was I got introduced to opiates.
Oh.
The first thing, there's two things in life that got me to stop drinking. One was Tyler.
Yeah.
And a 12-step program, right? And a treatment center.
Yeah.
And then the second thing that got me to never want to drink again was opiates. Oh. I was like, why would I ever drink?
Yeah,
like,
this is it.
I don't have to be bloated. And
yeah. Here we go.
I could mask it more. I'm not passing out somewhere.
Yet.
So,
yet.
And that was 2005. So this is the height the opioid epidemic.
Right.
Right. Had no idea what I was walking
into.
Well,
the opioid epidemic is at its height probably now.
Right.
But
right.
like at pill the height mill. Of when you can get everything easily.
Like when I watched.
And when it's like non-addictive, right?
Right.
Like at that
time. When I watched those documentaries now.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, that was me.
Yeah.
That was me.
God.
My family doctor that when I was a kid. He was writing me scripts. He didn't know.
Yeah.
He was just writing. He doesn't.
Well, they told them it's not addictive. All these studies are showing this is, you know, it's what's crazy is I know that family. Like, I knew their daughter. She would come to Greece with me and my friends. Like, how crazy is that? And, she, you know, anyway.
And I remember the first time I got discharged, I was with my sister at 2 weeks before I can fly back east. And she was giving me a pill, one every 4 hours. And I was taking it. Until I got home to my friends, they were like, what'd you get? Oh, you got to get these. They're 10 times stronger than these. Oof. And take them like this. And then, and that was it. I was off. And I was like, all right, I'll do another surgery in 10 weeks. And then another one after that in 10 weeks, because I'm going to keep getting all this stuff for free or $5.
So a lot of those surgeries may not have been necessary, but.
Well, here's the thing. No, they were all necessary. I could have like stopped the bleeding, but it was like, why? There was a surgery so I could avoid having the bag, and then there would be a complication with that one.
Right.
And then that one would lead to two more, and then they would say, get the bag, and I would say, no, let's go again. So then that would lead to a few more.
So it was all that to avoid what you inevitably had to get.
Right. And I wasn't ready to, like...
accept it.
It wasn't. No.
I would not want that either, of course. I mean, like, come on, let's be honest.
So that took me to, I can honestly say I've never bought like heroin and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I never needed to. Like through that whole, like 2005, my sobriety date is November 3rd, 2018.
Right.
So like 13 years.
Yeah.
Right?
Of
now
opiates.
Let's go back to that same question they asked me in treatment my first time. Like I haven't drawn a sober breath for 18 years.
Wow.
Like Adderall's involved, you know what I mean? All the pain medicine.
Well, you have to like balance out all the opiates, right? I mean, it's like a game.
And I had my stomach at this point looks like a roadmap. And there's like, now I do have the permanent ostomy, right? Which is not bad.
Yeah,
Like life is so much better. So to answer your question, yeah, if I could go back, I would have just taken the bag. But I was making it like I had this huge career and like, yeah, I had fun. But like party's over. Now you have some health issues that you need to address.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
Yeah.
And that took me to, I was 45 years old in 2018. That's when I went to Trinidad. That's when I met you.
Yeah.
So it was a tough road because the last 10 years, I put my family through hell. The people that love me the most, had a high-rise apartment where I was just like, isolate. Don't let anyone up. Doorman. No one's allowed up, right? Right. Doorman was like
Except my drug dealer.
Well, he was the doorman was my drug dealer. He did 10 years. My pain doctor, who was my friend's dad, did 25 to life.
Right.
And he was like from Villanova. Oh my God, main line of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
So I like dodged a bullet with no legal stuff, but I was just so stripped down of a human being you could imagine.
I can't even imagine.
And masking it as like all these problems with my health when it was actually mental health problems at that point.
So at this point, you're isolating in New York City. You're probably burning through whatever money you have left. And what was the culminating factor? Did you ask for help, or were you finally like, I need help, or did someone get led upstairs and see how you were living?
Well, no, I would fly out and see my sister.
Oh, okay.
I would nod out at the Thanksgiving dinner table. I wasn't isolated.
Right.
My life was isolated.
Right, right.
Like, no one would ask me what I do for a living because they would get a dishonest answer.
Right.
Like, they just knew, like, I was either, he's obviously, like, he's not modeling anymore, I tell you that much.
Right.
I don't know what he's doing. And
right.
It was like, I had a business card. I was like, I passed a real estate. I was like a realtor, but I wasn't.
Oh my God, that was the same with me. I was working for Corcoran. I was working as an assistant. Actually, I was working for her. God bless her. But anyway.
So it was another double life I was living.
Yeah.
Right? And I would see my family. I would go out. They didn't approve of how I looked. They didn't, question it. But then at the end, I was, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to jump off, I'm going to jump out of the window with my dog, Sebastian. And like,
oh, I love your dog, Sebastian.
I know. He's so cute. And he's 13 next week. So he's
been through it all with you.
He's been through it all.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about a sober breath. I haven't been a sober dad for like 13 years of this guy.
Wow.
And I put him through hell.
Broke his leg. Well, now you've been so, give him sober.
Yeah, he's this big. I broke his leg.
Ugh.
Like when he was like 7 years old, I was in a blackout and was like,
ugh.
And I drove the car, totaled the car. I had to like hitchhike from Ohio back to Philadelphia. It was like crazy.
So like consequence after consequence,
crisis
the whole
mode
nine.
With a pile high of consequences that just kept coming. And you know what? I honestly, after being through treatment, going through the steps with Tyler, I was convinced that I'm depressed. Because of the surgeries and the pills. And the pills took me down a road now that I'm dealing with this depression. And so my family hires a guy for me, to a psychiatrist, and I would have to drive to him. And I was just lying to him.
Yeah.
I was just lying to him.
Yeah.
And, my family did an intervention on me. It was like February of 2017. No, 18.
Yeah.
2018. And I ran out of it because I was high, like the stuff you see on those shows.
Yeah,
like, that's so far from who I am today. Like,
I ran
out of it. Like, I didn't have a cell phone. I'm on like 95, like trying to flag cars down. Oh, like, God. Out of my mind.
Sorry,
right?
I'm laughing, but that's
crazy. No. Well, my sister and I were just talking about it at dinner last night.
Wow.
And my little sister was there.
Yeah.
And my whole family was there. They're like, you need help. And I was like, you know what? I do, but this guy's not going to be able to help me. That was how I was. And and you know what? I went back to that apartment and I kept doing what I was doing until like June, July. I was like, I think I'm going to have to go to treatment now. This is not good. I'm like, I was also like the Adderall and the Xanax.
Like, the up and down.
And years of Xanax. Like, I never knew that coming off of that was harder than coming off
God,
of opiates.
Don't
so
even get me started.
I was trying to stop on my own, and it was just like, it was dangerous.
Yeah.
And
I had a seizure from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so blessed that I didn't have any of that because I lived alone.
That you know of.
Right.
That you know of.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
How so crazy I remember having my sisters calling. Karen, I was on the phone with Karen for like days. Something happened. The woman that I was speaking with on the phone no longer worked there. And then the person that they gave me to, I copped an attitude with her. It wasn't her, it was me.
Yeah, of course.
Then I said, you know what? I'll show you. I'm going to Hazelden.
Yeah.
And
I'll show you.
It's like an hour down the street. I'd go to Karen
yeah.
and I had to fly to Minnesota.
Yeah.
But I did. And I loved it. It was beautiful campus.
I've heard.
I was there for 3 months. Yeah. And you know what? It was such a great experience. I needed the camaraderie of other people. Yeah. I needed the camaraderie. I felt like I was at summer camp.
Well, addiction is, and substance use and addiction really leads to isolation. Mm-hmm. And the opposite, and recovery and healthiness is like, what do they say? It's inclusion. It's not isolating. There's a saying. I know. Yeah. I'm missing it now, but yeah.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I can't think of it either.
You gotta, but... Fellowship is like the major thing that we are missing, right? It's, there's the importance of helping others, but without fellowship, you can't do it. You know, you can't do it on your own.
So I laughed for the first time in a while when I was there. Guys that are, you know, half my age, guys that are 20 years older than me, we just had a good time.
Yeah.
And
belly laughs.
Yeah. Belly laughs. And my game plan was like, I didn't know, right? Am I going to go back to New York, Philadelphia, down here? I was like, let me stay in Minnesota. I'll just go. And my family's like, you're not going to make it in Minnesota.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I've lived all over the world. What do you mean? They're like, no, why don't you go down to Delray?
Yeah.
And I did. I went to Delray, you know, but I do have to say.
Like, I love it here.
Yeah,
oh
I do
God,
too.
It's the best.
But I recovered from surgeries from Cleveland Clinic in Delray.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. So yeah. I knew
Why
Del
Weston to Delray?
So I had a childhood buddy of mine. His family has a house in Delray.
And, got it.
And I
okay,
had like
so
the guest house after surgeries. Okay. And I would need to go back
yeah.
and forth.
Right,
so
of course.
It was just, yeah, better than being in a hotel. And mm-hmm. But Weston was where my surgeon still is and at Cleveland Clinic. And so I knew what Delray was about. I used to be in a relationship with someone that had over 20 years.
Oh my God.
So like when I went to treatment in 18, we were together for like 4 or 5 years and treatment was never an option for me.
Yeah.
Right? I was still thinking I'm going to pull this off somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't. So, you know, unfortunately and fortunately, because I have a great life, that we went our own ways and we weren't meant to be.
Right.
And I went to Hazelden and I came down here and I met Natalie.
Right, which is amazing. Like, I can't wait till she comes on the podcast.
I know.
But
I
your
know.
Wedding was so beautiful.
Thank
and
you.
I love
it was
it.
A lot of fun. Yeah. It was just so many blessings that have come to my life since I've been sober. I mean, you know, the camaraderie that I experienced in Hazelden, coming down here, getting dialed in with the home group and, you know, all my friends, the yeah. group, we have a pretty solid group. And yeah. and we do it together, you know, and I don't know where I would be without those guys. It's not about like the treatment center. It's about the camaraderie, the
Absolutely.
Friends that I have.
The afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, are
the
you,
accountability.
What are you doing? What
the
are you
sponsorship
doing for your sobriety?
Jimmy, you know?
You know? Yeah.
I mean, I spent 8 hours, 9 hours a day with my sponsor for the first few years.
Wow.
That's he a would lot. Pick me up in the morning. We'd go to the gym at 5 a.m., go to the 7 a.m., and then I would go to work with him all day.
Oh, I didn't know.
When we
okay.
started that company.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I spent more time with him than I did with my wife. Like it was, it's great
crazy.
Though. I mean, it's great. Just truly excited to, you know, to, and now where I am, I have to not force myself, but I don't want to be the upperclassman. Like I want to still help guys, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
But it's tough when you're married and you're trying to have a baby and you start a business
yeah.
and like, but you need
your
to
wife
do
has
it.
Just started a business.
Yeah.
Very successful so far. You know,
it's
everything
so
is
much
amazing.
Fun.
Yeah.
I mean, from scratch.
I know.
Right.
I
and
know.
It's only been up and running for 2 months now.
I
and
know.
It's just so exciting.
I know. I mean, she worked with me and
that's right.
I'll never forget it. I was like, this girl is so talented. So good. I knew it from day one. I was like her cheerleader. I was like, I know
she
you're
works
gonna be
so
amazing.
Hard. She's
yeah.
so passionate about it.
I
remember her saying it to me when we were, this was like 5 years ago. She's like, or 4 years ago. She's like, I'm going to own my own gym.
Good for her.
I was like,
I'm so happy.
Okay.
So tell me, so you came to Delray after Hazelden and what did, so it looked like hanging out with your sponsor all day long going to work, but it really was like you went to a 12-step meeting. You were involved with people. Fellowship, mm-hmm. having fun, volunteering, giving yourself your time to others. Like, what else were you doing? What did early sobriety look like?
So early sobriety for me was the guy said, if you're going to do this, if you want me to sponsor you, you're going to come here every day.
Yeah.
I come here every day.
Yeah.
You know, he has 41 years he's celebrating.
Yeah.
Like, so I was like, all right. He's like, can you come here every day? Yes. All right. So we do that. And then he goes, Wednesday night, we do fellowship dinner. every Wednesday night. You and the boys, get them together. We're going out to dinner. And then we would do like H&I commitments where we would go bring meetings inside
and
of meetings.
Just H&I commitments, just for anyone who doesn't know, means hospitals and institutions. And it's when you bring a 12-step meeting to either a hospital or a prison, you know, jail, prison, and or a psych ward, like anything that is doesn't have that access, right? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because it introduces people to a better way of life, mm-hmm. right?
Bridges the gap.
Yeah.
It really helps people realize that when you're out of this institution, there is help for you. There's a group, there's a community of people that want to be in recovery mm-hmm. and are willing to help you for free.
For free.
Right? So that was huge.
You don't even have to give that dollar.
It was for free.
No one's going to judge.
I was forced by my sponsor to start the H&I commitment with.
Good.
With immersion.
That's great.
And
do you still go all the time or
to the meeting?
To that Tuesday? I'm just curious.
No. So I had the chair for 2 years and then I passed the torch
and then it's been passed down for over the years. Yeah.
So for the first few years I went like all the time, like Dean and Nancy are now.
Yeah.
And then because it was tough to get speakers during COVID. Yeah. So I was going a lot. But it opened the door to that whole opportunity for these people to bridge the gap. Like I see guys that are in there and then they come out, they get a year, they get 2 years.
And they do it again.
Yeah. And now they're going back. It's just like this whole cycle.
It's so beautiful.
And yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. So H&I, I was doing H&I, I was doing fellowship dinners with the guys. We were at one point, we were trying to travel once a week to a meeting, like mm-hmm. a men's speaker meeting in like Miami or here. And that was fun. You know, but sharing the message and trying to sponsor guys.
Yeah.
And it was tough when you have a few years to try to sponsor guys and, but it was fun. And I have a few sponsors that, I have a sponsee that turned out to be a really good friend of mine.
That's awesome.
Which, you know, Peter.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he's great. He's great. I mean, we've been together for like 6 years.
It's crazy.
We're like brothers.
Peter. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I actually texted him recently just to see how he's doing.
He's doing good.
Yeah, he's doing good.
Yeah, he'll be back in October.
Good.
So, yeah, just staying involved with the community. And, you know, we have such a great group of guys. We were talking before we started how we're branching off. We're at men's meetings there now because the influx of people just come in. We're touching like 150 people
Isn't
a day.
Isn't it incredible?
Like minimum 150 people a day.
Man.
And you know, that's something that we really to remain grateful for because if I did move back to Denver or you know, they don't have meetings like
that. No, they don't. And even when I go visit my family in New Jersey, like I know in New York City they have a ton of meetings, but in New Jersey where I live, don't get me wrong, they have them, but they're like extremely like weird times, once a week, or, you know, it's hard. It's hard. I've heard that there's other fellowships that have more meetings than the one I'm a part of, but, you know, it's nothing like down here. And I've been spoiled with down here where, you know, there's no shortness of meetings or whatever. There's no shortcomings of meetings. Yeah. They're all over all the time.
I mean, I try to get sober in L.A., and there's a ton of meetings in L.A., in New York.
So what would you say that, hold on one second. We're at 50, perfect timing, yes. Okay, so what would you say that you're doing today that's different from what you did 6 years ago?
So I'm leaning more into my relationship with God, my higher power.
Yeah.
Like 100% is what I'm doing now.
That.
You know, when the accountability is still there with my group of guys, but when you're, they say like when you're, it's between you and a drink.
Yeah.
Right. You have to have some relationship.
Absolutely.
So I've been working on that.
Yeah.
Trusting God, God's will, not mine, you know, cause my will and my first thoughts are not.
I know. You would think they would get better.
They could have their own podcast.
Yeah. So that, and what else would you say is really important to
staying involved with my group?
Yeah.
Like I don't know if upperclassmen ring, like for me, it was like, once you become the senior, you don't want to hang out with the freshmen.
Yeah,
you
know? I like hanging out with the freshmen.
Yeah, well, I didn't, yeah, you know, unless they were girls. I mean, but we go, like, staying involved with the with my group of guys, yeah, and, you know, the guys that are coming in. And yeah, it's not tough. Right. It can be challenging at times, but it's not tough.
Right.
I mean, like you and I said, it's down here, it's like
easy.
Easy. It really is.
Makes it easy. So what would you say, I guess, if you could give some advice to someone who is out there watching this struggling, or they have a family member who's struggling, or, you know, what would you say?
You know, I would say, the first thing you should get rid of is the shame, because with addiction comes shame.
Yeah.
And when you have the shame weighing you down, you're shameful to admit it. You're shameful of what you've done. Like, relieve that shame and forgive yourself.
Yeah.
You know, this is a disease. Just go get some help.
Right.
I mean, there's so many more options now than these guys that, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Just try to get to a point where you can love yourself again. I also, like a guy has told me when I first came in, was, you know, try to think about yourself less than 50% of the day. And if you can do that, that's like a good day.
Yeah.
Right. And when we're ready to go to treatment, when you're in the grips of it, it's 100%. You're thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
Like, how did I do this?
Yeah.
What's going to happen to me? Where am I going to go? Like, how do you, I don't know. Like, pray it away. Like, talk to somebody. Like, get involved with a therapist or a group, a community.
Yeah.
A fellowship. And, you know, try to get rid of self. And that's what's helped me a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you have to get to the right place. You have to get to, like, somewhere safe, mm-hmm, you know, as if you're not in a safe place, if you're surrounded by it, you have to get out of that situation too, right? You have to separate yourself. So on this, is there anything that you haven't shared that you want to, first of all?
No, I think I covered everything. I mean, any more,
I think there's enough stories. We could talk for hours, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But... thank you so much for sharing. I do have a question that I ask everyone. So what, if you could say anything to your younger self, it could be like younger, 10 years ago, younger, or it could be like 8 years old, younger. What age would you choose? And what would you say to that young Joey?
You know, that's such a good question. I wish you would have texted me that so I could think about it. But
no, the whole point is to put you on the spot.
So what I would say to myself, I don't know the age, but I'm going to say around teens, right? Like early teens to like 15. I would say, it's okay. You don't have to be better than these people. It's okay. You don't need to be smarter.
Right.
You don't need more money.
Right.
Everything you need, you have.
Right.
You just got to dig into it. It's going to take a little bit of work. Like, honestly, you know, I just, we always wanted to be a little bit cooler. We always wanted to be smarter, wanted our families to have more money.
And yeah,
like, that's where I came from. It was, you know, it was a very diverse area, but there was a lot of money, and there was like kids that didn't have it, wanted it. And like, and I always wanted to like go to school. When everyone was going to college, I wasn't going to college. I was going to party.
Right.
You know, like I had a whole different like path. And I wouldn't change it. Honestly, I would not change it. I saw the world. I truly did. I had a lot of culture through traveling and stuff. And just tell myself, it's just like, it's okay to be you. It really is.
It is. Yeah. I love that. That's so good.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh my God. Amazing. Well, let's hug.
Yeah. Let's hug it out. Let's hug.